Medical Matters on Talk About, brought to you in association with the Bon Secours Hospital Tralee, celebrating 100 years of advanced medicine and exceptional care.
Now, welcome to Dr. Eamon Shanahan.
Deirdre, how are you doing?
I'm not too bad at all. Now, Eamon, I asked you today to talk about a little bit about mental health, and it might be seem a bit strange to be talking about it during the summer. But I had a very lengthy and interesting conversation with a chap who rang yesterday, and he was asking the question, and I think it's a good question, why is it that when somebody is referred by their GP for to be perhaps admitted to the psychiatric services in UHK, why is it that they have to go through A&E? And as you were telling me off air, first of all, there's a very good reason for that.
Okay, fair enough. I think what people have to realise that I'd say for the last 15 years, with very, very, very few exceptions, anybody who needs to be admitted, not just to University Hospital Kerry, but to the best of my knowledge, every single public hospital in the country must go through the emergency department or some other outpatient department in the first instance. The reason for that is because a long time ago, the indemnifiers, the people who pay the insurance for all the health services, determined that people being admitted directly to wards was a dangerous activity. It was exceptionally rarely, but it wasn't unheard of for people to be admitted to wards, not seen on the wards, and then for stuff to happen to them on the wards. You could say that every casualty in the country, to a greater or lesser extent at this stage, is heaving mass of humanity. But the assessment is that at least if you're in casualties, somebody somewhere is going to see you, as opposed to being in the ward where you may not be spotted. So that's the reason. And as it is not just for mental health issues, it's for all the services.
And Eamon, we said as well today, we might talk a bit about when, like a lot of people will have mental health problems during their lives. I think one in four of us, and possibly more than that.
Indeed.
When does it spill over from a scenario whereby a chat with the GP is required into a more serious scenario?
I think the easiest way to describe that, put it in terms of the degree to which the person can function. Now, what I mean by that is simply, literally, the degree to which they can carry out their normal day-to-day activities. So depending on the particular symptoms, and I suppose you need to start looking at along the spectrum then of the anxiety, depression kind of problems through to the potentially more serious issues like schizophrenia and other related illnesses. There are times when people with very severe depression or anxiety may require inpatient treatment. And what does the inpatient treatment offer that you don't have the outside? It's actually mostly a place of safety. It's mostly a place where the person can be kept an eye on so that no harm comes to them. On the other hand, if somebody does suffer from what's called a psychotic illness, where they have very pronounced hallucinations or delusions, it may be that so as that they can get the correct treatment, they need to be admitted to hospital. And there is a vanishingly small number of cases, and it genuinely is very, very small number of cases, where under the very, very strict rules of the Mental Health Act, an individual can be compulsorily admitted to hospital. It rarely happens. I'm thinking of probably four times in the last probably 15 years of my career that we've had to use this. so it's a rare thing. But normally it's a case where the person just absolutely can function, and where the normal measures that would be involved in the community, medication and counselling, are not working.
Okay, so that's the distinction there. Eamon, you probably saw, like I did earlier this week, a study from the ESRI which showed that more than half of women in their early 20s were depressed due to the pandemic, causing significant disruption to their lives. Are we starting to see now some of the mental health after effects of COVID?
We're not starting, we're there. I mean, the thing is, there's lots of people struggled mightily and continue to struggle as a result. I mean, the reality is we certainly hope it's a once in a century experience, although unfortunately it may not be. But the reality is that if you look at the disruption that happened to people over the last 2 years, this was an enormous disruption to individuals. And in large measure, it boils down to ability to cope. resilience. Now, I would argue that the most resilient of individuals, given the right or the wrong set of circumstances, will crack as well. But certainly there's no doubt that building in resilience is something we need to do more of. Nevertheless, we are where we are, and therefore we are picking up the pieces and dealing with the kind of problems that people have. As Deirdre, as you know well, my own philosophy in this thing is I will be looking for the talking therapies, counselling and psychotherapy before we resort to medication. But there are certainly times when we might need me to use medication, but it should be second or third choice rather than first choice.
I wonder, Eamon, though, that having said that, are there enough people out there in the professional counselling services, and note I say professional counselling services, to go around to cope with this increase?
And the answer is, you're quite right. The reality is that while, to be fair, the situation is an awful lot better than it would have been, say, 10 or 15 years ago, we still don't have enough of the therapists and psychotherapists and counsellors that we need. There is access to services, but there's waiting lists everywhere, I should say, and that's irrespective of whether you go publicly or privately.
Okay. So what sort of telltale signs should we be on the lookout for, perhaps family members, friends, work colleagues who are reaching the point where they do need a medical intervention?
Yeah, I suppose it's the best way I can describe it is when people reach the end of their tether. Now, the problem is that it depends on the individual. Some people will throw off lots of signals. They're clearly anxious, they're clearly agitated, they're clearly very down themselves. They'll be seen crying frequently. You know, you'll have all these kind of signals. The problem is that there are a number of people who are very good at masking their symptoms, and the difficulty is that you may not be aware of how down a person is. And certainly professionally seen people who are carrying jobs with significant responsibility across all sectors of society, and you wouldn't know what to look at them, that they were struggling, but that by golly, when I close the door of the surgery and they talk to me, by golly, they are struggling.
Yeah, and sometimes it's the people you least expect that are the ones who are struggling.
And you're absolutely right, and that's the difficulty. In the extremely busy lives that we lead, part of the problem is space and time, time to reflect, time to decompress, time to just chill out and relax. These are things, and you know, things like switching off the flipping mobile devices, not being accessible to people out of hours, whatever occupation or whatever you do in your own life, it's just trying to create personal space and time. And it's actually going back to fundamental stuff, stuff that, you know, transcendental meditation, the new thing, reflective behaviours and mindfulness. What I'm driving at is that we need time to allow ourselves to decompress, and we're not getting that time.
Yeah, and scrolling through your mobile phone for a half an hour is not relaxing.
Oh, Jesus, so doom scrolling is not a great idea. And it, you know, I mean, I can well understand, I saw statistics where something like, is it 30 or 40% of people have just stopped watching the news anymore because they see it as an unending litany of disasters and one thing after another. But then the problem is that because social media is so pervasive, and I won't say any of the social media, because there are lots and lots of social media that you can scroll through, and unfortunately you don't have to go far before you start seeing the darker sides and the darker depths of humanity.
And that's before we even deal with the amount of misinformation that's out there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's the problem, yeah.
Eamon, coming back to the women in their early 20s who are depressed due to the pandemic and depressed for any reason.
Yeah.
So one of these women decides to go to their GP and explains everything to their GP, how they're feeling. What typically happens then? Does their GP refer them to a specific counsellor, or do they have to go away and find one themselves?
The answer is yes to all of the above. I think in the first instance what you're looking at is in many cases, not in every case, but in many cases, your GP will be somebody you've been attending for a number of years, and they will know all about you. And in many cases, even just having that discussion with the GP in itself can be beneficial and helpful. Beyond that, then there are the various professional services. for medical card holders, there's SIPSI counselling and primary care, which is a service that we can refer medical card patients to. For people who don't have medical cards, there are a variety of therapists and counsellors out there, and most GPs would know the name of a few of them and will give people names. Beyond that, another resource is the Psychological Association of Ireland. If you go to their website, and they will list all the therapists in any given area and also what their particular interests are. So that's another way that you could seek help.
And there are a lot of very good organisations like Jigsaw out there.
Yeah, and oh, absolutely. And one other resource is that I know the HSE have been making, there are, on the positive side of using the mobile phones, there are mindfulness apps that are available that can help people as well. There are a number of resources, not enough, but there are a number of resources there.
Okay, very good. Well, listen, Eamon, we're going to take a quick break at this stage and allow the listeners to mull over what you've been saying, and perhaps they might get in touch with us if they have a question. Now, we will prioritise queries to do with mental health issues. So if you're maybe concerned about yourself, concerned about a loved one, do let us know if you want Eamon's advice. The usual numbers apply. We will prioritise mental health queries, but if you want to send in a general, we'll say, physical health query, we'll take those as well on 083 300 3300. 16 minutes past two, you're listening to Talk About on Radio Kerry. Back with more from Eamon after these.
Medical Matters on Talk About, brought to you in association with the Bonsecours Hospital Tralee, celebrating 100 years of advanced medicine and exceptional care.
Right, well, Eamon, we've lots of questions for you.
Sure.
We don't have any about mental health, but we have quite a few about physical health. So we'll plough on with some of those for the time being.
Yeah.
But again, if anyone has any further queries about mental health, 066 712 3666. Now, here is an interesting one, Eamon, from a 41-year-old healthy female. She says, I got COVID 9 days ago. The only symptom I'm left with is tiredness. I'm getting 10 hours sleep a night, but I'm still very tired during the day. Should I push through the tiredness and get on with my day, or should I give in and rest or sleep during the day? I'm not due back at work until Monday.
Yeah, no. Funny enough, I was talking with Jerry this earlier this morning about this topic, and I was saying that one of the issues that we have, to Jerry Sullivan, one of the issues we have for people who get COVID is the fatigue and the brain fog. I think that the situation is, the advice we're hearing at the moment is it's like every other post-viral fatigue syndrome. I think the trick is you have to listen to your body. It's about a graduated return to exercise. In other words, don't suddenly go mad and start doing vast amounts of exercise. Gradually increase your exercise tolerance over a period of time. For the majority of people, the fatigue does lift in time being usually days to weeks, but I've certainly seen it going on for months and longer. So it's got to be gradually rehabilitating yourself after you had. Don't forget the virus, it's a whole of body assault on the individual. It's literally every single part of the body that gets attacked by this darn thing. So you will need a while to recover from it. And again, post-viral fatigue is not a new thing. We've seen it for decades in teenagers with glandular fever.
Okay, a lady in her 70s has been diagnosed with a round glass nodule in her lung. What does that mean for her, and what is the remedy? What is the remedy or cure?
Remedy, yeah. Okay, fair enough. This is something, right? I think the slight typo there. It's actually ground glass, and it's you know, the appearance of, you know, the when the radiologist looks at the X-ray picture, it looks like looking through, you know, opaque glass. That's the analogy they're using. It indicates there's a lesion of some sort in the lung. This will require further investigation by the relevant specialist, who most usually will be a respiratory physician or a chest specialist. They may decide if the lesion is fairly small, just to keep an eye on it and make sure that it doesn't grow, or if it is large, or if there's other features that they're concerned about, they may have to take a sample of tissue from it. They might have to biopsy it, and then only then would you be able to work out what exactly is the cause of the problem.
Now, here's a mental health question, Eamon. A listener wants you to talk about agoraphobia. Isn't that fear of going out and about, is it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This person The question is, what course of action is best? It was suddenly brought on by a panic attack and it's gotten worse.
Yeah. See, I suspect myself there's a bit of a chicken and egg going on here. A panic attack is merely a physical manifestation of underlying anxiety. A panic attack occurs when somebody's production of adrenaline peaks and they begin to feel, they then become conscious of the symptoms of the production of the extra adrenaline, which in turn makes them feel very anxious in themselves. So I suspect that there was an underlying state here. Agoraphobia can be difficult to treat, and it is extremely disabling because it's a socially restricting condition. Like all forms of anxiety, though, probably the most effective way of treating this in the long run is cognitive behavioural therapy or some related therapy, because basically what that's about is trying to identify what are the triggers. So it's the ABC, it's the activating event. Something triggers the person feeling anxious. That in this case might be as simple as opening their front door. The consequence, the C part of it, is that they feel extremely anxious. What is the belief system in between? Why is it that the person has developed this fear of going out and trying to address those fears? And the problem is you've got this idea of secondary gain, that there may not be an obvious reason for it, but there always is a reason, and it's trying to find out what the reason is. Worst case scenario I'd be looking at is finding the way and means of coping with it. And I've certainly seen people who have had quite severe agoraphobia and over time have been able to address this. One really important point to make, and I think this is hugely important to say from the get-go, it should be the exception and the significant exception to the rule that a person would be medicated for this. There can be an associated depression for which the person can sometimes benefit from treatment, but for the pure anxiety itself, there is no effective therapy that is not addictive. That's the problem. There are plenty of therapies available, but they have significant addictive potential.
Now let's move on. We've a lady who suffers from acid reflux. She's had a camera down her throat and everything was okay. She's taken meds but nothing has helped. Is there any other reason or way of seeing if there's another issue causing the reflux? She does have a thyroid issue. Would there be a connection?
Okay, the anything is possible, but it's unlikely. Reflux unfortunately just means that acid from the stomach is coming back up into the esophagus, into the gullet, and is causing burning there. The ways of trying to deal with that in the first instance are by using medications that reduce or stop the production of acid in the stomach. Other things that can be of use is to avoid wearing tight-fitting clothing and to avoid and to try and lose weight, because if there's a tummy there, it'll push the acid up into the esophagus. If the problem persists, rarely, and it is rarely, there is a procedure, a surgical procedure that can be done that tightens up the lower end of the esophagus and can reduce the risk of reflux. The only problem with that procedure is that you've got to be so careful, because if it's done too severely, you'll then have the opposite problem. You won't be able to swallow. So for most people, it's taking the medication regularly, trying to avoid those foods that are triggers. I love rich food cake, but it certainly does not love me. And then trying to get the weight down.
Okay. Now this is a slightly long query, Eamon, but just bear with me. It's a lady in her early 40s. She's suffering from breast pain at the moment and her breast feels heavy. She says the breast does not have dimpling and it looks fine, but it feels like the right breast is bigger than the left. It's a bit swollen, yeah. I think, under the right arm. Yeah. Is this normal and can I take anything to alleviate the pain? It feels like this about 2 weeks out of every month.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. And presumably that the 2 weeks of the month is the key to this, that we're looking at something that's cyclical. Now, on the face of it, if this is something that was coming and staying, for me as a general practitioner, what I'd be doing is referring this lady to the breast clinic to be seen in due course of time to be checked out. Mastalgia, breast pain, is a not uncommon problem. And the treatment that the breast clinics are recommending is evening primrose oil. Camelinic acid. So this is something I think you can buy off the counter. You don't even need a prescription for it. And this can be very useful for relieving the symptoms. Again, because our listener is over the age of 40, it may or may not be a perimenopausal related symptom, and it might be worthwhile talking to your GP about that. If there's any doubts whatsoever, and the thing that has me just a bit bothered is the fact that she feels one breast is slightly bigger than the other one. I'm a bit itchy, a bit twitchy about that. I would be, for myself personally, I'd be more comfortable if she were to get this thing checked out. Go get checked, and then if everything is okay, you can take your evening primrose oil with a peaceful mind.
A listener says, will you ask Eamon, is chronic urticaria a sign of diabetes? I have it almost 2 years on the palms of my hands, and I get terrible slumps of no energy throughout the day, and I'm starting to wonder if I could be diabetic.
Well, it is enough to work out whether somebody is diabetic or not. There's a specific blood test, I think, called the hemoglobin A1C. That is now the diagnostic test for diabetes. There's another older test called the glucose tolerance test. And yeah, either of those tests will tell you whether you're diabetic or not. I think it's the other way around. If somebody has diabetes, they're more prone to develop, they can develop skin conditions as a consequence. But chronic urticaria is a condition in its own right. I think the big problem with chronic urticaria means it's hives, that's what you're talking about. And chronic urticaria means just it's going on forever. And what it is that the person is releasing large amounts of histamine under their skin that gives them the symptoms. The problem is that is draining, and that's part of the reason why the darn thing is why you feel so tired in yourself. But if you're concerned about diabetes, your own GP can do a very simple test that'll be able to tell you definitively whether you have diabetes or not.
Margaret in Listowel says, will you ask Eamon his opinion on cannabis oil for Parkinson's? I'm in my mid-70s and I feel it has deteriorated lately.
Yeah, I mean, this is a subject I've talked about on a number of occasions. The cannabinoids, in all their various forms, are hit and miss. Certainly, there have been some individuals in whom cannabinoids can be dramatically effective. The difficulty is that, like most biological agents, in other words, an agent that's derived ultimately from a plant, it's very, very, very variable. Some individuals get benefit, other individuals will not get benefit. And the difficulty is that to a certain extent you're probably not going to know until you try. But in truth, if truth be told, it's not part of the conventional therapy because it's not something you can sort of say, oh, right, you've got this particular condition and this will guarantee to sort you out, because we don't know. And in the majority of cases, unfortunately, it won't.
One more we'll squeeze in, Eamon, before we let you go. And it's from a lady in her 70s. She had the booster shot on Monday and now her arm is sore and swollen. She's wondering, is this normal?
Yes, it is. And it's an indication that your immune system is working very well. I mean, not much consolation when you have a sore arm. But the point about it is that what's happening there is that your body is mounting a defence against the particles in the actual vaccine. And in that way, they're generating many, many, many antibodies that would be protective against the worst of excesses of COVID.
Very good. Eamon, we're going to leave it there for this week. Thank you so much for joining us.
Not a bother, Catherine. I'll talk to you again.
I will talk to you very soon. That's Dr. Eamon Shanahan there with this week's Medical Matters.